Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. My name is Crawford Gribben, and today I'm delighted to welcome Jonathan Lukatu, who is here to talk about his new book, The Christology of Ignatius of Antioch, just published by Cascade Books at the end of 2023. Jonathan, it's great to have you back on the show. It's been a couple of years since you were here before to talk about your last book, I think, a commentary on the Epistle of Barnabas, which was a fascinating book and a great discussion.
Oh, well, thank you. And thanks very much for having me back on. It's great to be able to talk to you again.
Thanks, Jonathan. Before we jump into this new book on the Christology of Ignatius of Antioch, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, yeah. So I teach in South Korea. I teach at the Presbyterian University and Theological Seminary in Seoul. And my teaching duties are related to the English language. So I teach conversation for predominantly undergraduate students who are wanting to learn. And then I also teach some sort of graduate reading and writing courses that allow me to engage more deeply in theology and in early Christianity for graduate students.
That's great, Jonathan. Now, you're obviously a very modest scholar because your publication record extends far beyond early Christianity. You've got interest in the Inklings and other kinds of things as well. But this is your second monograph on Ignatius of Antioch, and you've written a lot of articles about Ignatius. You've translated some work about Ignatius too. What's the background to this project in particular?
Yeah, Ignatius has kind of functioned as a sort of center point in my research. In other ways, I'm really not focused, as you mentioned. Yeah, so some interest in the Inklings and some other things going on that I enjoy. But Ignatius always kind of stands at the center. And I suppose what draws me to Ignatius and what keeps me interested in this research is just how unique I think he is. There's a lot of puzzles in his letters, a lot of things to look at and to reflect on. And as well, there's a lot of there's a number of interesting things going on in Ignatian scholarship, and so that allows me to sort of stay in touch with people and to engage with what's going on. So I, more than anything, I just like learning about Ignatius and like engaging with others who are studying him.
So just imagine some of our listeners don't know very much about Ignatius. How would you summarize his life? What do we know about his biography?
Absolutely. Yeah. So one of the puzzling things about Ignatius is that we just don't know very much about his life. We can fill in some gaps, and church history has certainly done that. But in essence, what we know for sure is that we have these letters that are written in his name. And these letters are purported to have been written as he was being transported as a criminal from Antioch to Rome. And he wrote them in the middle of that journey, mostly in Asia Minor, which is more or less halfway between Antioch and Rome. And he wrote these letters expecting to die. So he's gone down in Christian history as a martyr. And I suppose for my part, I've tended to accept at least that much of the story. Then there's a lot of other questions that we could ask and that get asked in scholarship, such as why was he arrested? Was it initiated by the Romans, or was it some sort of problem perhaps within his community of Christians or Jesus followers in Antioch? We could perhaps also ask what he did exactly in Antioch. He refers to himself as a bishop, but what did that mean for his particular service and his time in that city? And all of that remains fairly open-ended, I think. So there's a lot of room to debate and to explore and to study.
I was fascinated by that aspect of the book because you tell us that there are hints in the letters of unhappiness in that Christian community, that perhaps Ignatius's emphasis upon the authority of the bishop, or his demand really that Christians not observe the Eucharist in the absence of a bishop, hinted at some of the problems that might exist.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's a distinct possibility. And there's a lot of other Ignatian scholars who emphasize that as well. So yeah, I do. I that's a possibility, I think, that that something went wrong for him in Antioch, or at least that he had some difficulties with his community there. It doesn't necessarily mean that the Romans didn't also give him a hard time, that there might not have been external pressure. But it seems that everything might not have been perfectly at peace whenever Ignatius was there in Antioch. And I think maybe that comes out in the letters because, as you mentioned rightly, he's quite emphatic that unity needs to characterize the church, and that unity should center around Jesus and around the Eucharistic practice.
And he's not scared of death, is he?
He's not, no. In fact, I think unfairly, but just to show how unafraid he is, some scholars have characterized him as being kind of borderline psychotic or unstable, because he does he's utterly unafraid. He almost seems to look forward to it. I think he looks forward to it out of a conviction that he's following Jesus, and he sees his death as an imitation of Christ. But that lack of fear has led some people to think that maybe there is something actually just unstable or wrong about him.
There's an interesting line or two in his writing where he speaks about death as something that will make him truly human. And I suppose that's one of the paradoxes that's typical of Ignatius, isn't it? But what's he getting at when he says that?
Yeah, he does write with lots of paradoxes, which often leave me scratching my head, and this is one of them, I think. I'm inclined to think that what he means is that in order to be fully human, someone must follow Christ, someone must follow Jesus, and that entails death. And perhaps we could make space in certain parts of Ignatius' letters for other ways of following Jesus. But in Ignatius' case, what he sees that as is literally following Jesus to death, presumably in Rome and perhaps in the Colosseum. And in that, he sees himself through death, he sees himself as obtaining God or obtaining Christ. And this completes who he was meant to be. And so in terms of his understanding of what it means to be human, death is central because death unites the believer with God.
So it's a fascinating biography. It raises lots of questions of interpretation, historical and other types of interpretation. And it's preserved for us in these groups of letters. But one of the things that you do in the book is to show us how complicated is the textual history of these letters. Could you talk us through that and perhaps tell us why you prefer what's known as the middle recension?
Sure, yeah. So this is one of the problems that keeps me consistently fascinated with Ignatius. As you mentioned, there's a number of letters that float around in Ignatius' name. I think if we took the largest count, we could have 17 letters that float around in Ignatius' name. But if anyone who's listening happens to pick up a copy of the Apostolic Fathers, which is the collection of texts where Ignatius' letters are usually published, almost any modern edition of the Apostolic Fathers will only have 7 letters. And so scholars have tended to talk in terms of a short and a middle and a long recension. And the long recension refers to a collection of letters of perhaps 12 or 13 or 17, that in general are longer in form than the middle recension and also contain more letters. So they're longer. The shorter recension, as we might expect, contains fewer letters than the middle recension. It only has three. And it's shorter. The letters compared to the middle recension are abbreviated. And then there's the middle recension. And in this regard, I suppose I am somewhat traditional, at least over the last 200 years or so of scholarship. A majority of scholars in that time have thought that the middle recension is authentically Ignatius, that the long recension represents someone else writing later in Ignatius' name and perhaps furthering their own theological purposes, and the shorter recension maybe represents an abridgment. That position could perhaps be in the midst of being rethought in scholarship. So I'm aware that there's some people who are hinting or perhaps arguing that the short recension maybe deserves a better hearing. And so that'll be interesting to watch how that goes in the next few years. But for now, I've maintained that the middle recension is the oldest recension, and I think the genuine letters of Ignatius of Antioch.
And what do these letters tell us about Christology, which is the main subject of your book?
Yeah. So they tell us, I think, a couple of things that might sound fairly clear to anyone who's familiar with early Christian Christology, or perhaps for that matter with later Christologies as well, but that Ignatius puts into somewhat odd terms or striking terms. He tells us, for example, that Jesus is divine and not just there were lots of divine beings in the Greco-Roman world, but Jesus is not just one of those sort of divine or semi-divine beings. But actually, I think he tells us that Ignatius is divine in the same way that Israel's God, that God the Father is divine. And he says that quite explicitly. He uses the Greek word theos, which means God, or is kind of the basic Greek word for God. And Ignatius reserves the word God only for Jesus and the Father. It does not refer to any other beings. And so there is this unique and very high element. Ignatius uses the word God more often for Jesus than any other earlier Christian writer. And at the same time, he also refers to Jesus' humanity, and he does so again in very striking terms. He's absolutely emphatic that if someone does not think that Jesus was human, that they should not be included in the church or among the group of believers. They're excluded, they're discounted in some way. And so both Jesus' humanity and Jesus' divinity are absolutely central for Ignatius, but he doesn't really reconcile how this is possible. He just sets them side by side. And so at one point he even refers to the blood of God, which is an extremely striking, perhaps troubling for later theologians, a troubling phrase. But it's one that Ignatius uses, and I think it illustrates well how he both elevates Jesus' divinity and elevates Jesus' humanity, that both both are present and neither can be neglected.
And I suppose this is why you describe Ignatius as having one of the highest and one of the lowest Christologies. It goes in both directions, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah, I think that's right. He's unapologetic and unrelenting in those regards. He just sets them side by side, and he expects his audience, I think, to agree.
Does that tell us something interesting about early Christian theology, that it is content to live with paradox?
I think that's right. I think it does. We see a similar phenomenon a little bit later, at least, sorry, in the back of my mind, I'm aware that there are dates about or debates about when Ignatius wrote. But on my dating, a little bit later, there's a fellow named Melito of Sardis, and he similarly writes with all sorts of paradoxes in his writing. And then going the other way, perhaps going earlier, I think we could find elements of paradox in the letters of Paul or the Gospel of John. I think early Christians are, to varying degrees and in different ways, fairly happy with elements of paradox in their thinking.
So these letters, whichever recension we prefer, these letters of Ignatius are a goldmine of Christological reflection, aren't they? And I think one of the great values of your book is the way in which you work through descriptors or designations of Jesus and images of Jesus, some of which are very familiar to us as New Testament readers. Others are much less familiar to us and maybe demonstrate something of the creativity, theological creativity, of Ignatius and his contemporaries. What are some of the most interesting designations of Jesus for you in the Ignatian corpus?
As you say, there's a number of traditional ones. Lord and God and Christ are all used to describe Jesus, and that will be familiar to anyone who has perhaps read any bit of the New Testament or other early Christian writers. But then, he also refers to Jesus as a star. It's one of the images that he uses. And when he refers to Jesus as a star, he's actually right in the middle of telling us about Jesus' birth and death. And he's emphasizing Jesus' humanity. And then all of a sudden, he begins to tell this kind of story about a star. And I've argued that star is not just representative of Jesus' birth, but actually it stands for Jesus himself. And it's another way in which Ignatius tells us who Jesus is. So Jesus is this human being who was born. Ignatius identifies him with David. He died. He is this very human person. And through the star, Ignatius also illustrates that there are these effects of his birth and his death that are important for the entire cosmos. So it's not just Jesus himself, but the effects of his birth and his death, and I think we can perhaps assume, although Ignatius doesn't say it in this passage, his resurrection, the effects of all of that are that that death no longer has the same power, that corruption stops, that the effects are universal and global, and they extend far beyond Ignatius' own experience in Antioch or Jesus' work in Palestine. They are universal. If I could perhaps just mention one more, Ignatius also refers to Jesus as the archives. And it's this very, in that context, he's in this quite polemical mode of argument. He's having some trouble, or he's had some trouble, with the people that he's writing to. And they seem to be appealing to the Old Testament, and they refer to the Old Testament or the Jewish scriptures as the archives. And Ignatius' response is that for him, Jesus is the archives. And what is inviolable, or what cannot be set aside about those archives, are his appearance, his coming in the flesh, and his death and his resurrection, and the faith that's mediated through him. And so I think there Ignatius is saying that at the center of Jewish scripture stands Christ, which is slightly ironic because Ignatius doesn't quote from scripture much, but he still, I think, holds this very much in the center of his thought.
So those are fascinating images, Jonathan. When Ignatius refers to Jesus as archive, Is he suggesting that the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, reveal Jesus, or that Jesus reveals the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament?
That's an interesting question. I think he would, I think he would argue that Jesus reveals the Old Testament and that Jesus makes sense or enables believers to make sense of the Old Testament. The one thing that makes me pause about that is, I guess, just to clarify it, I think that's true, that Jesus makes sense of the Old Testament. I'm also aware that some have argued that Jesus perhaps replaces the Old Testament or something like that. I don't think that Ignatius says that, but I might be in the minority in that view.
That would be quite a bold move for him to make if he did think that, wouldn't it?
It would be. Replacement is perhaps too strong, but denigrates might be maybe the more dumb. Or perhaps that Ignatius is inept or just didn't know the scriptures very well. I've tried to argue against those positions, but I do think Jesus reveals the Old Testament.
Another image that you dwell on in the book is the image of Jesus as Chorus. What's that all about?
Jesus becomes almost like a choir leader or a dance leader in some of Ignatius' imagery. And he does that, I think, to depict the sort of unity that should be present in every church that he writes to, although he only uses this image a couple of times. Jesus tends to stand at the center of that image and tends to be a kind of mediator between the Father and then the rest of the chorus, which is presumably the believers that Ignatius is writing to. And so the image becomes inviting, I think, to readers, that Jesus stands at the center and the readers are invited to participate. It's an active image, both presumably for what Jesus does, but also for how readers ought to react to that image. There's presumably, if someone is leading you in a dance, you should join in. So I think that readers are invited to imagine themselves. And then that image gets extended at one point to almost allude to the bishop, so that the bishop takes on a similar kind of role. And so Ignatius does this in a number of ways, but the chorus imagery is one where the bishop stands in some way as a representative of Jesus or of the Father. And presumably should thus be followed or obeyed or respected as a result.
So this maybe raises the bigger question of the relationship between Ignatius's Christology and his ecclesiology. How do the two things correlate?
Yeah, I think they correlate pretty closely. And I suppose in the book, I try to draw that out in three ways. Let's see if I can remember them all here. Ignatius, he connects Jesus' Christology first and foremost, or at least most personally, to his own death. Jesus is someone who died and was raised, and that resurrection passion story is very much at the center of Ignatius' Christology. And as a result, Ignatius and his readers as well are called to follow Jesus. And for Ignatius, that means following him in death. There's also an imitation element, which is quite closely connected to martyrdom, but might be expanded in the case of other believers. I do think that sacrifice and ultimately perhaps death in some form is important for how Ignatius understands the Christian life. But it is death that leads somewhere. It's not the death in itself. It is death that brings someone into an imitation and a unity with Jesus. And then the third element, and the one that has drawn a lot of attention in Ignatian scholarship, is how Ignatius views hierarchy in the church. And so for Ignatius, it's absolutely vital that there are these three levels of hierarchy in the church. Bishops, elders, and deacons are the traditional English names. But what sometimes gets overlooked in scholarship is just how closely connected that is to Ignatius' understanding of Jesus, that it's Jesus who initiates that hierarchy, and also it's Jesus and the Father and perhaps the apostles. There's different people, different representatives, but that these ecclesial leaders represent and instantiate in some ways Jesus for the community.
Well, Jonathan, that's fascinating, and what a fascinating discussion of such an important book, The Christology of Ignatius of Antioch, just published by Cascade Press, the end of 2023. Jonathan, you're obviously a busy writer. Are you planning any current projects at the moment?
You know, I'm still trying to find my next kind of major project. I think at some point I hope to write a commentary on Ignatius' letters. So Ignatius will still be central to what I do, and perhaps there will be some other things along the way as well. But Ignatius, I think, will still stand very much in the middle of my work.
Well, that sounds exciting, and maybe we could invite you back to chat about that commentary or some other projects in due course. That would be wonderful. Well, yeah. It's been great to speak to you today, Jonathan. Thank you so much for your time. Jonathan Lukudu, author of The Christology of Ignatius of Antioch, just published by Cascade Books at the end of 2023. Thanks to you for tuning in today, and I'll see you next time on the New Books Network.
Thanks so much, Crawford.